Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Authorizing Class Arbitration Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 25, 2013, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Oxford Health Plans LLC v. Souter. The question in this case is whether an arbitrator acts within his power under the Federal Arbitration Act, as the Second and Third Circuits have held, or exceeds those powers, as the Fifth Circuit has held, by determining that the parties affirmatively agree to authorize class arbitration based solely on their use of broad cultural contract language precluding litigation and requiring arbitration of any dispute arising under their contract. To discuss the case, we have Beau Rutledge, who is a professor of law at the University of Georgia School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Rutledge.
So the case of Oxford Health Plans versus Souter addresses two issues that have arisen periodically in the last decade in arbitration law. Specifically, first, whether and under what circumstances an arbitrator may conduct a class arbitration, that is, a arbitration involving an aggregate of claimants against a single respondent. And second, the role of courts, specifically federal courts, in reviewing the arbitrator's decision. The backstory to this case arises from a professional services agreement through a health plan and a physician, under which the physician agrees to provide health care services to the health plan's members at a certain reimbursement rate in return for preferred access to that health plan's members. A dispute arose, and in this instance, the physician initiated arbitration against the health plan, and the question arose whether or not this arbitration should proceed as a class on behalf of many physicians who likewise were in similar agreements with the health plan. This question harkened back to a series of decisions where the Supreme Court has confronted the question of class arbitration in the past. A little over a decade ago, in a case called Basel, the Supreme Court first confronted the question whether and under what circumstances a arbitrator could order class arbitration. And as to that question, a loose plurality of the court spoke in terms of deferring to the arbitrator's decision. Several years later, as a result of the fractured decision in Basel, the Supreme Court stepped in again in a case called Stolt-Nielsen. Stolt-Nielsen involved an international arbitration where the parties had stipulated that the arbitration agreement was silent as to whether or not the arbitration clause permitted class action. The arbitrator, in light of that stipulation, ordered a class arbitration, and ultimately the Supreme Court held that the arbitrator's order needed to be set aside, or in arbitral lingo, needed to be vacated. Stolt-Nielsen was built on the Supreme Court's decision in AT&T versus Concepcion, the two being related, as to the question when a party consents to arbitration, is it consenting to arbitration with a specific contract partner, or is it consenting instead to a process which includes a degree of deference to the arbitrator's procedural decisions? In Stolt-Nielsen, like Concepcion, both conceptualized arbitration in terms of a consent to process. So the way we get from Stolt-Nielsen to Oxford Health Plans is here we don't have a stipulation as to whether or not the arbitration agreement is silent as to that matter. We have a generalized arbitration clause under which the parties simply consent to sending any disputes to arbitration before the American Arbitration Association and the results of the arbitrator's decision being final and binding. So as referenced earlier, the arbitrator in this case orders class arbitration, something to which Oxford Health Plan strenuously objects. So when it reaches the court, again, the twofold question is first, to what extent is a court bound to defer to the arbitrator's decision as to class arbitration? And second, if the court disagrees with it, when and under what circumstances can it step in? In the oral argument, the court seemed quite comfortable with the notion that deference to the arbitrator's decision does not mean sort of wholesale acceptance. And the counsel for Oxford Health Plan, Seth Waxman at WilmerHale, who has argued arbitration cases before the court in the past, seemed very able to get the court to accept the fact that there was room for judicial review of an arbitrator's decision to order class arbitration in the face of a silent agreement. What became slightly more difficult was for Seth Waxman to articulate a principled view upon which an arbitrator's class arbitration decision could be set aside. The Supreme Court's earlier decision in Stolt-Nielsen had suggested a somewhat confusing blend of grounds, either Section 10A4 of the Federal Arbitration Act, which authorizes a court to vacate an award where the arbitrator has exceeded his powers, as well as the so-called manifest disregard of the law doctrine, a doctrine that first appeared in Supreme Court jurisprudence in the early 20th century, some dated even a century earlier, which the court had arguably interred a few years earlier in a case called Hall Street versus Mattel, but Stolt-Nielsen sort of dusted that decision off and at least left open the possibility that a court could set aside an award for manifest disregard of the law. And while the court seemed sympathetic with the notion that some degree of judicial review, whether anchored in statute or in common law doctrine, was appropriate, where Waxman struggled was being able to articulate a principled position about why class arbitration decisions are more vulnerable to that type of review without completely throwing open all of the procedural decisions that an arbitrator might make, and thereby depriving parties of the benefit of their bargain, that is, sending a dispute to arbitration and thereby taking it outside of the ambit of the courts. When the counsel for the respondent, the physician Eric Katz, took the stand, it was clear that a majority of the court was skeptical of the notion that the arbitrator properly constructed the contract, and even, perhaps more surprising, that a coalition, perhaps an unusual coalition of justices, Alito, Scalia, Sotomayor, as well as Breyer, all seemed quite comfortable with the notion that there was ample opportunity for judicial review of the arbitrator's decision on class arbitration. This is surprising because in the wake of the earlier referenced Hall Street decision, a number of lower federal courts read Hall Street as interring the manifest disregard of the law doctrine. And although Stolt-Nielsen suggested that perhaps Section 10A4 provides a statutory hook for this sort of review, talking heads in the court in the wake of the Oxford Health Plan oral argument suggests that it's likely that the court will come down and find that the arbitrator both misconstrued the contract and that this misconstruction supplied a basis for judicial vacatur of the award. Perhaps the most interesting thing will be to see exactly in what the court grounds that basis for vacatur, whether it be the text of the statute or the Federal Arbitration Act itself. Unless one simply analyzes Supreme Court decisions in isolation, this decision will obviously sort of factor into the broader legislative debate about the proper role of arbitration in the resolution of disputes. A number of bills are pending in Congress. A number of proposals are kicking around the CFPB that would in various ways prohibit arbitration or regulate arbitration. And what the Supreme Court says both about the availability of aggregate litigation mechanisms in arbitration, as well as the opportunity for courts to second-guess arbitrators' decisions, will no doubt have an influence on Congress's view and the CFPB's view about whether and to what extent reform of the arbitral system in the United States is necessary and appropriate.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.